Meanwhile, I had turned, at the investigator's request, from the portrait of Cézanne to what was going on inside my head when I shut my eyes. This time, the inscape was curiously unrewarding. The field of vision was filled with brightly colored, constantly changing structures that seemed to be made of plastic or enameled tin. Cheap, I commented. Trivial. Like things in a 5 and 10. And all this shoddiness existed in a closed, cramped universe. It's as though one were below decks in a ship, I said. A 5 and 10 cent ship. And as I looked, it became very clear that this 5 and 10 cent ship was in some way connected with human pretensions, with the portrait of Cézanne, with A.B. among the Dolomites overacting his favorite character in fiction. This suffocating interior of a dime store ship was my own personal self. These gimcrack mobiles of tin and plastic were my personal contributions to the universe. I felt the lesson to be salutary, but was sorry nonetheless that it had had to be administered at this moment and in this form. As a rule, the mescaline taker discovers an inner world as manifestly a datum, as self-evidently infinite and holy, as that transfigured outer world which I had seen with my eyes open. From the first, my own case had been different. Mescaline had endowed me temporarily with the power to see things with my eyes shut, but it could not, or at least on this occasion did not, reveal an inscape remotely comparable to my flowers or chair or flannels out there. What it had allowed me to perceive inside was not the Dharma body in images, but my own mind. Not suchness, but a set of symbols, in other words, a homemade substitute for suchness. Most visualizers are transformed by mescaline into visionaries. Some of them, and they are perhaps more numerous than is generally supposed, require no transformation. They are visionaries all the time. The mental species to which Blake belonged is fairly widely distributed even in the urban industrial societies of the present day. The poet-artist's uniqueness does not consist in the fact that, to quote from his descriptive catalogue, he actually saw those wonderful originals called in the sacred scriptures the cherubim. It does not consist in the fact that these wonderful originals seen in my visions were some of them 100 feet in height, all containing mythological and recondite meaning. It consists solely in his ability to render, in words or somewhat less successfully in line and color, some hint at least of a not excessively uncommon experience. The untalented visionary may perceive an inner reality no less tremendous, beautiful, and significant than the world beheld by Blake, but he lacks altogether the ability to express, in literary or plastic symbols, what he has seen. From the records of religion and the surviving monuments of poetry and the plastic arts, it is very plain that at most times and in most places, men have attached more importance to the inscape than to objective existence. Have felt that what they saw with their eyes shut possessed a spiritually higher significance than what they saw with their eyes open. The reason? Familiarity breeds contempt, and how to survive is a problem ranging in urgency from the chronically tedious to the excruciating. The outer world is what we wake up to every morning of our lives, is the place where, willy-nilly, we must try to make our living. In the inner world there is neither work nor monotony. We visit it only in dreams and musings, and its strangeness is such that we never find the same world on two successive occasions. What wonder, then, if human beings in their search for the divine have generally preferred to look within? Generally, but not always. In their art, no less than in their religion, the Taoists and the Zen Buddhists look beyond visions to the void, and through the void at the 10,000 things of objective reality. Because of their doctrine of the Word made flesh, Christians should have been able from the first to adopt a similar attitude towards the universe around them. But because of the doctrine of the fall, they found it very hard to do so. As recently as 300 years ago, an expression of thoroughgoing world denial and even world condemnation was both orthodox and comprehensible. Quote, "We should feel wonder at nothing at all in nature, except only the incarnation of Christ." Close quote. In the 17th century, Lallemand's phrase seemed to make sense. Today, it has the ring of madness. In China, the rise of landscape painting to the rank of a major art form took place about 1,000, in Japan about 600, and in Europe about 300 years ago. The equation of Dharma body with hedge was made by those Zen masters who wedded Taoist naturalism with Buddhist transcendentalism. It was therefore only in the Far East that landscape painters consciously regarded their art as religious. In the West, religious painting was a matter of portraying sacred personages, of illustrating hallowed texts. Landscape painters regarded themselves as secularists. Today we recognize in Seurat one of the supreme masters of what may be called mystical landscape painting. And yet this man, who was able more effectively than any other to render the one in the many, became quite indignant when somebody praised him for the poetry of his work. "I merely apply the system," he protested. In other words, he was merely a pointilliste, and in his own eyes, nothing else. A similar anecdote is told of John Constable. One day, towards the end of his life, Blake met Constable at Hampstead and was shown one of the younger artist's sketches. In spite of his contempt for naturalistic art, the old visionary knew a good thing when he saw it, except, of course, when it was by Rubens. "This is not drawing," he cried. "This is inspiration." "I had meant it to be drawing," was Constable's characteristic answer. Both men were right. It was drawing, precise and veracious. And at the same time, it was inspiration. Inspiration of an order at least as high as Blake's. The pine trees on the heath had actually been seen as identical with the Dharma body. The sketch was a rendering, necessarily imperfect but still profoundly impressive, of what a cleansed perception had revealed to the open eyes of a great painter. From a contemplation, in the tradition of Wordsworth and Whitman, of the Dharma body as hedge, and from visions, such as Blake's, of the wonderful originals within the mind, contemporary poets have retreated into an investigation of the personal, as opposed to the more than personal, subconscious, and to a rendering in highly abstract terms, not of the given objective fact, but of mere scientific and theological notions. And something similar has happened in the field of painting, where we have witnessed a general retreat from landscape, the predominant art form of the 19th century. This retreat from landscape has not been into that other inner divine datum, with which most of the traditional schools of the past were concerned, that archetypal world where men have always found the raw materials of myth and religion. No, it has been a retreat from the outward datum into the personal subconscious, into a mental world more squalid and more tightly closed than even the world of conscious personality. These contraptions of tin and highly colored plastic, where had I seen them before? In every picture gallery that exhibits the latest in non-representational art. And now someone produced a phonograph and put a record on the turntable. I listened with pleasure, but experienced nothing comparable to my seen apocalypses of flowers or flannel. Would a naturally gifted musician hear the revelations which for me had been exclusively visual? It would be interesting to make the experiment. Meanwhile, though not transfigured, though retaining its normal quality and intensity, the music contributed not a little to my understanding of what had happened to me and of the wider problems which those happenings had raised. Instrumental music, oddly enough, left me rather cold. Mozart's C minor piano concerto was interrupted after the first movement, and a recording of some madrigals by Gesualdo took its place. These voices, I said appreciatively, these voices, they're a kind of bridge back to the human world. And a bridge they remained even while singing the most startlingly chromatic of the Mad Prince's compositions. Through the uneven phrases of the madrigals, the music pursued its course, never sticking to the same key for two bars together. In Gesualdo, that fantastic character out of a Webster melodrama, psychological disintegration had exaggerated, had pushed to the extreme limit, a tendency inherent in modal, as opposed to fully tonal music. The resulting work sounded as though they might have been written by the later Schoenberg. And yet, I felt myself constrained to say, as I listened to these strange products of a counter-reformation psychosis working upon a late medieval art form, and yet it does not matter that he's all in bits. The whole is disorganized, but each individual fragment is in order, is a representative of a higher order. The highest order prevails even in the disintegration. The totality is present even in the broken pieces, more clearly present, perhaps, than in a completely coherent work. At least you aren't lulled into a sense of false security by some merely human, merely fabricated order. You have to rely on your immediate perception of the ultimate order. So in a certain sense, disintegration may have its advantages. But of course it's dangerous, horribly dangerous. Suppose you couldn't get back out of the chaos. From Gesualdo's madrigals we jumped across a gulf of three centuries to Alban Berg and the lyric suite. This, I announced in advance, is going to be hell. But as it turned out, I was wrong. Actually, the music sounded rather funny. Dredged up from the personal subconscious, agony succeeded 12-tone agony. But what struck me was only the essential incongruity between a psychological disintegration even completer than Gesualdo's and the prodigious resources in talent and technique employed in its expression. "Isn't he sorry for himself?" I commented with a derisive lack of sympathy. And then, Katzenmusik, learned Katzenmusik. And finally, after a few more minutes of the anguish, who cares what his feelings are? Why can't he pay attention to something else? As a criticism of what is undoubtedly a very remarkable work, it was unfair and inadequate, but not, I think, irrelevant. I cite it for what it is worth, and because that is how, in a state of pure contemplation, I reacted to the lyric suite. When it was over, the investigator suggested a walk in the garden. I was willing, and though my body seemed to have dissociated itself almost completely from my mind, or, to be more accurate, though my awareness of the transfigured outer world was no longer accompanied by an awareness of my physical organism, I found myself able to get up, open the French window, and walk out with only a minimum of hesitation. It was odd, of course, to feel that I was not the same as these arms and legs out there, as this wholly objective trunk and neck and even head. It was odd, but one soon got used to it, and anyhow the body seemed perfectly well able to look after itself. In reality, of course, it always does look after itself. All that the conscious ego can do is to formulate wishes, which are then carried out by forces which it controls very little and understands not at all. When it does anything more, when it tries too hard, for example, when it worries, when it becomes apprehensive about the future, it lowers the effectiveness of those forces and may even cause the devitalized body to fall ill. In my present state, awareness was not referred to as ego. It was, so to speak, on its own. This meant that the physiological intelligence controlling the body was also on its own. For the moment, that interfering neurotic, who in waking hours tries to run the show, was blessedly out of the way. From the French window, I walked out under a kind of pergola covered in part by a climbing rose tree, in part by laths, 1 inch wide, with half an inch of space between them. The sun was shining, and the shadows of the laths made a zebra-like pattern on the ground and across the seat and back of a garden chair, which was standing at this end of the pergola. That chair, shall I ever forget it? Where the shadows fell on the canvas upholstery, stripes of a deep but glowing indigo alternated with stripes of an incandescence so intensely bright that it was hard to believe that they could be made of anything but blue fire. For what seemed an immensely long time, I gazed without knowing, even without wishing to know, what it was that confronted me. At any other time I would have seen a chair barred with alternate light and shade. Today the percept had swallowed up the concept. I was so completely absorbed in looking, so thunderstruck by what I actually saw, that I could not be aware of anything else. Garden furniture, laths, sunlight, shadow, these were no more than names and notions, mere verbalizations, for utilitarian or scientific purposes after the event. The event was this succession of azure furnace doors separated by gulfs of unfathomable gentian. It was inexpressibly wonderful, wonderful to the point almost of being terrifying. And suddenly I had an inkling of what it must feel like to be mad. Schizophrenia has its heavens as well as its hells and purgatories. I remember what an old friend, dead these many years, told me about his mad wife. One day, in the early stages of the disease, when she still had her lucid intervals, he had gone to talk to her about their children. She listened for a time, then cut him short. How could he bear to waste his time on a couple of absent children, when all that really mattered, here and now, was the unspeakable beauty of the patterns he made in this brown tweed jacket every time he moved his arms. Alas, this paradise of cleansed perception, of pure one-sided contemplation, was not to endure. The blissful intermissions became rarer, became briefer, until finally there were no more of them. there was only horror. Most takers of mescaline experience only the heavenly part of schizophrenia. The drug brings hell and purgatory only to those who have had a recent case of jaundice, or who suffer from periodical depressions or a chronic anxiety. If, like the other drugs of remotely comparable power, mescaline were notoriously toxic, the taking of it would be enough of itself to cause anxiety. But the reasonably healthy person knows in advance that so far as he is concerned, mescaline is completely innocuous, that its effects will pass off after 8 or 10 hours, leaving no hangover and consequently no craving for a renewal of the dose. Fortified by this knowledge, he embarks upon the experiment without fear, in other words, without any disposition to convert an unprecedentedly strange and other than human experience into something appalling, something actually diabolical. Confronted by a chair which looked like the Last Judgment, or to be more accurate, by a Last Judgment which, after a long time and with considerable difficulty, I recognized as a chair, I found myself all at once on the brink of panic. This, I suddenly felt, was going too far. Too far, even though the going was into intenser beauty, deeper significance. The fear, as I analyze it in retrospect, was of being overwhelmed, of disintegrating under a pressure of reality greater than a mind accustomed to living most of the time in a cozy world of symbols could possibly bear. The literature of religious experience abounds in references to the pains and terrors overwhelming those who have come too suddenly face to face with some manifestation of the mysterium tremendum. In theological language, this fear is due to the incompatibility between man's egotism and the divine purity, between man's self-aggravated separateness and the infinity of God. Following Boehmer and William Law, we may say that by unregenerate souls, the divine light at its full blaze can be apprehended only as a burning, purgatorial fire. An almost identical doctrine is to be found in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, where the departed soul is described as shrinking in agony from the pure light of the void, and even from the lesser, tempered lights, in order to rush headlong into the comforting darkness of selfhood as a reborn human being, or even as a beast, an unhappy ghost, a denizen of hell. Anything rather than the burning brightness of unmitigated reality. Anything. The schizophrenic is a soul not merely unregenerate, but desperately sick into the bargain. His sickness consists in the inability to take refuge from inner and outer reality, as the sane person habitually does, in the homemade universe of common sense, the strictly human world of useful notions, shared symbols, and socially acceptable conventions. The schizophrenic is like a man permanently under the influence of mescaline, and therefore unable to shut off the experience of a reality which he is not holy enough to live with, which he cannot explain away because it is the most stubborn of primary facts, and which, because it never permits him to look at the world with merely human eyes, scares him into interpreting its unremitting strangeness, its burning intensity of significance, as the manifestations of human or even cosmic malevolence, calling for the most desperate countermeasures, from murderous violence at one end of the scale to catatonia or psychological suicide at the other. and once embarked upon the downward, the infernal road, one would never be able to stop. That now was only too obvious. If you started in the wrong way, I said in answer to the investigator's questions, everything that happened would be a proof of the conspiracy against you. It would all be self-validating. You couldn't draw a breath without knowing it was part of the plot. So you think you know where madness lies? My answer was a convinced and heartfelt yes. And you couldn't control it? No, I couldn't control it. If one began with fear and hate as the major premise, one would have to go on to the conclusion. Would you be able, my wife asked, to fix your attention on what the Tibetan Book of the Dead calls the clear light? I was doubtful. Would it keep the evil away if you could hold it, or would you not be able to hold it? I considered the question for some time. Perhaps, I answered at last, perhaps I could, but only if there was somebody there to tell me about the clear light. One couldn't do it by oneself. That's the point, I suppose, of the Tibetan ritual, someone sitting there all the time and telling you what's what. After listening to the record of this part of the experiment, I took down my copy of Evans Wentz's edition of the Tibetan Book of the Dead and opened at random. O nobly born, let not thy mind be distracted. That was the problem, to remain undistracted. Undistracted by the memory of past sins, by imagined pleasure, by the bitter aftertaste of old wrongs and humiliations, by all the fears and hates and cravings that ordinarily eclipse the light. What those Buddhist monks did for the dying and the dead, might not the modern psychiatrist do for the insane? Let there be a voice to assure them by day and even while they are asleep, that in spite of all the terror, all the bewilderment and confusion, the ultimate reality remains unshakably itself, and is of the same substance as the inner light of even the most cruelly tormented mind. By means of such devices as recorders, clock-controlled switches, public address systems, and pillow speakers, it should be very easy to keep the inmates of even an understaffed institution constantly reminded of this primordial fact. Perhaps a few of the lost souls might in this way be helped to win some measure of control over the universe, at once beautiful and appalling, but always other than human, always totally incomprehensible, in which they find themselves condemned to live. None too soon, I was steered away from the disquieting splendors of my garden chair. Drooping in green parabolas from the hedge, the ivy fronds shone with a kind of glassy, jade-like radiance. A moment later, a clump of red-hot pokers in full bloom had exploded into my field of vision, so passionately alive that they seemed to be standing on the very brink of utterance, the flowers strained upwards into the blue. Like the chair under the laths, they protected too much. I looked down at the leaves and discovered a cavernous intricacy of the most delicate green lights and shadows, pulsing with undecipherable mystery. Roses. The flowers are easy to paint, the leaves difficult. Shiki's haiku, which I quote in R. H. Blyth's translation, expresses by indirection exactly what I then felt, the excessive, the too obvious glory of the flowers, as contrasted with the subtler miracle of their foliage. We walked out into the street. A large, pale blue automobile was standing at the curb. At the sight of it, I was suddenly overcome by enormous merriment. What complacency, what an absurd self-satisfaction beamed from those bulging surfaces of glossiest enamel. Man had created the thing in his own image, or rather in the image of his favorite character in fiction. I laughed till the tears ran down my cheeks. We re-entered the house. A meal had been prepared. Somebody who was not yet identical with myself fell to with ravenous appetite. From a considerable distance and without much interest, I looked on. When the meal had been eaten, we got into the car and went for a drive. The effects of the mescaline were already on the decline, but the flowers in the gardens still trembled on the brink of being supernatural. The pepper trees and carobs along the side streets still manifestly belonged to some sacred grove. Eden alternated with Dodona, Yggdrasil with the mystic rose. And then, abruptly, we were at an intersection waiting to cross Sunset Boulevard. Before us, the cars were rolling by in a steady stream, thousands of them, all bright and shiny like an advertiser's dream, and each more ludicrous than the last. Once again, I was convulsed with laughter. The red sea of traffic parted at last, and we crossed into another oasis of trees and lawns and roses. In a few minutes we had climbed to a vantage point in the hills, and there was the city spread out beneath us. Rather disappointingly, it looked very like the city I had seen on other occasions. So far as I was concerned, transfiguration was proportional to distance. The nearer, the more divinely other. This vast, dim panorama was hardly different from itself. We drove on, and so long as we remained in the hills, with view succeeding distant view, significance was at its everyday level, well below Transfiguration Point. The magic began to work again only when we turned down into a new suburb and were gliding between two rows of houses. Here, in spite of the peculiar hideousness of the architecture, there were renewals of transcendental otherness, hints of the morning's heaven. Brick chimneys and green composition roofs glowed in the sunshine like fragments of the New Jerusalem. And all at once I saw what Guardi had seen and with what incomparable skill had so often rendered in his paintings. A stucco wall with a shadow slanting across it, blank but unforgettably beautiful, empty but charged with all the meaning and the mystery of existence. The revelation dawned and was gone again within a fraction of a second. The car had moved on. Time was uncovering another manifestation of the eternal suchness. Within sameness there is difference. But that difference should be different from sameness is in no wise the intention of all the Buddhas. Their intention is both totality and differentiation. This bank of red and white geraniums, for example, it was entirely different from that stucco wall 100 yards up the road. But the isness of both was the same. The eternal quality of their transience was the same. An hour later, with 10 more miles and the visit to the world's biggest drugstore safely behind us, we were back at home, and I had returned to that reassuring but profoundly unsatisfactory state known as being in one's right mind. That humanity at large will ever be able to dispense with artificial paradises seems very unlikely. Most men and women lead lives at the worst so painful, at the best so monotonous, poor, and limited, that the urge to escape, the longing to transcend themselves if only for a few moments, is and has always been one of the principal appetites of the soul. Art and religion, carnivals and saturnalia, dancing and listening to oratory, all these have served in H.G. Wells's phrase as doors in the wall. And for private, for everyday use, there have always been chemical intoxicants. All the vegetable sedatives and narcotics, all the euphorics that grow on trees, the hallucinogens that ripen in berries or can be squeezed from roots, all, without exception, have been known and systematically used by human beings from time immemorial. And to these natural modifiers of consciousness, modern science has added its quota of synthetics. Chloral, for example, and benzedrine, the bromides, and the barbiturates. Most of these modifiers of consciousness cannot now be taken except under doctor's orders, or else illegally and at considerable risk. For unrestricted use, the West has permitted only alcohol and tobacco. All the other chemical doors in the wall are labeled dope, and their unauthorized takers are fiends. We now spend a good deal more on drink and smoke than we spend on education. This, of course, is not surprising. The urge to escape from selfhood and the environment is in almost everyone almost all the time. The urge to do something for the young is strong only in parents, and in them only for the few years during which their children go to school. Equally unsurprising is the current attitude towards drink and smoke. In spite of the growing army of hopeless alcoholics, in spite of the hundreds of thousands of persons annually maimed or killed by drunken drivers, popular comedians still crack jokes about alcohol and its addicts. And in spite of the evidence linking cigarettes with lung cancer, practically everybody regards tobacco smoking as being hardly less normal and natural than eating. From the point of view of the rationalist utilitarian, this may seem odd. For the historian, it is exactly what you would expect. A firm conviction of the material reality of hell never prevented medieval Christians from doing what their ambition, lust, or covetousness suggested. Lung cancer, traffic accidents, and the millions of miserable and misery-creating alcoholics are facts even more certain than was in Dante's day the fact of the Inferno. But all such facts are remote and unsubstantial compared with the near, felt fact of a craving here and now for release or sedation, for a drink or a smoke. Ours is the age, among other things, of the automobile and of rocketing population. Alcohol is incompatible with safety on the roads, and its production, like that of tobacco, condemns to virtual sterility many millions of acres of the most fertile soil. The problems raised by alcohol and tobacco cannot, it goes without saying, be solved by prohibition. The universal and ever-present urge to self-transcendence is not to be abolished by slamming the currently popular doors in the wall. The only reasonable policy is to open other, better doors in the hope of inducing men and women to exchange their old bad habits for new and less harmful ones. Some of these other, better doors will be social and technological in nature, others religious or psychological, others dietetic, educational, athletic. But the need for frequent chemical vacations from intolerable selfhood and repulsive surroundings will undoubtedly remain. What is needed is a new drug which will relieve and console our suffering species without doing more harm in the long run than it does good in the short, Such a drug must be potent in minute doses and synthesizable. If it does not possess these qualities, its production, like that of wine, beer, spirits, and tobacco, will interfere with the raising of indispensable food and fibers. It must be less toxic than opium or cocaine, less likely to produce undesirable social consequences than alcohol or the barbiturates, less inimical to heart and lungs than the tars and nicotine of cigarettes. And on the positive side, it should produce changes in consciousness more interesting, more intrinsically valuable than mere sedation or dreaminess, delusions of omnipotence, or release from inhibition. To most people, mescaline is almost completely innocuous. Unlike alcohol, it does not drive the taker into the kind of uninhibited action which results in brawls, crimes of violence, and traffic accidents. A man under the influence of mescaline quietly minds his own business. Moreover, the business he minds is an experience of the most enlightening kind, which does not have to be paid for, and this is surely important, by a compensatory hangover. Of the long-range consequences of regular mescaline taking, we know very little. The Indians who consume peyote buttons do not seem to be physically or morally degraded by the habit. However, the available evidence is still scarce and sketchy. In his monograph, Menomonee Peyotism, published December 1952 in the Transactions of the American Philosophical Society, Professor J. S. Slotkin has written that the habitual use of peyote does not seem to produce any increased tolerance or dependence. I know many people who have been peyotists for 40 to 50 years. The amount of peyote they use depends upon the solemnity of the occasion. In general, they do not take any more peyote now than they did years ago. Also, there is sometimes an interval of a month or more between rites, and they go without peyote during this period without feeling any craving for it. Personally, even after a series of rites occurring on four successive weekends, I neither increased the amount of peyote consumed nor felt any continued need for it. It is evident with good reason that peyote has never been legally declared a narcotic or its use prohibited by the federal government. However, during the long history of Indian white contact, white officials have usually tried to suppress the use of peyote because it has been conceived to violate their own mores. But these attempts have always failed. In a footnote, Dr. Slotkin adds that it is amazing to hear the fantastic stories about the effects of peyote and the nature of the ritual, which are told by the white and Catholic Indian officials in the Menomonee Reservation. None of them have had the slightest first-hand experience with the plant or with the religion, yet some fancy themselves to be authorities and write official reports on the subject. Although obviously superior to cocaine, opium, alcohol, and tobacco, mescaline is not yet the ideal drug. Along with the happily transfigured majority of mescaline takers, there is a minority that finds in the drug only hell or purgatory. Moreover, for a drug that is to be used like alcohol for general consumption, its effects last for an inconveniently long time. But chemistry and physiology are capable nowadays of practically anything. If the psychologists and sociologists will define the ideal, the neurologists and pharmacologists can be relied upon to discover the means whereby that ideal can be realized. Or at least, for perhaps this kind of ideal can never in the very nature of things be fully realized, more nearly approached than in the wine-bibbing past, the whiskey-drinking, marijuana-smoking, and barbiturate-swallowing present. The urge to transcend self-conscious selfhood is, as I have said, a principal appetite of the soul. When, for whatever reason, men and women fail to transcend themselves by means of worship, good works, and spiritual exercises, they are apt to resort to religion's chemical surrogates, alcohol and goof pills in the modern West, alcohol and opium in the East, hashish in the Mohammedan world, alcohol and marijuana in Central America, alcohol and coca in the Andes, alcohol and the barbiturates in the more up-to-date regions of South America. In Poison Sacré, Ivresse Divine, Philippe de Félice has written at length and with a wealth of documentation on the immemorial connection between religion and the taking of drugs. Here, in summary, or in direct quotation, are his conclusions. The employment for religious purposes of toxic substances is, quote, extraordinarily widespread. The practices studied in this volume can be observed in every region of the earth, among primitives no less than among those who have reached a high pitch of civilization. We are therefore dealing not with exceptional facts which might justifiably be overlooked, but with a general and, in the widest sense of the word, a human phenomenon, the kind of phenomenon which cannot be disregarded by anyone who is trying to discover what religion is and what are the deep needs which it must satisfy. End of quote. Ideally, everyone should be able to find self-transcendence in some form of pure or applied religion. In practice, it seems very unlikely that this hoped-for consummation will ever be realized. There are, and doubtless there always will be, good churchmen and good churchwomen, for whom, unfortunately, piety is not enough. The late G.K. Chesterton, who wrote at least as lyrically of drink as of devotion, may serve as their eloquent spokesman. The modern churches, with some exceptions among the Protestant denominations, tolerate alcohol. But even the most tolerant have made no attempt to convert the drug to Christianity or to sacramentalize its use. The pious drinker is forced to take his religion in one compartment, his religion surrogate in another. And perhaps this is inevitable. Drinking cannot be sacramentalized except in religions which set no store on decorum. The worship of Dionysus or the Celtic god of beer was a loud and disorderly affair. The rites of Christianity are incompatible with even religious drunkenness. This does no harm to the distillers, but is very bad for Christianity. Countless persons desire self-transcendence and would be glad to find it in church. But alas, the hungry sheep look up and are not fed. They take part in rites, they listen to sermons, they repeat prayers, but their thirst remains unassuaged. Disappointed, they turn to the bottle. For a time at least, and in a kind of way, it works. Church may still be attended, but it is no more than the musical bank of butlers ere one. God may still be acknowledged, but he is God only on the verbal level, only in a strictly Pickwickian sense. The effective object of worship is the bottle, and the sole religious experience is that state of uninhibited and belligerent euphoria which follows the ingestion of the third cocktail. We see, then, that Christianity and alcohol do not and cannot mix. Christianity and mescaline seem to be much more compatible. This has been demonstrated by many tribes of Indians from Texas to as far north as Wisconsin. Among these tribes are to be found groups affiliated with the Native American Church, a sect whose principal rite is a kind of early Christian agape, or love feast, where slices of peyote, take the place of the sacramental bread and wine. These Native Americans regard the cactus as God's special gift to the Indians and equate its effects with the workings of the divine spirit. Professor J. S. Slotkin, one of the very few white men ever to have participated in the rites of a peyotist congregation, says of his fellow worshippers that they are, quote, certainly not stupefied or drunk. They never get out of rhythm or fumble their words as a drunken or stupefied man would do. They are all quiet, courteous, and considerate of one another. I have never been in any white man's house of worship where there is either so much religious feeling or decorum. End of quote. And what, we may ask, are these devout and well-behaved peyotists experiencing? Not the mild sense of virtue which sustains the average Sunday churchgoer through 90 minutes of boredom, not even those high feelings inspired by thoughts of the Creator and the Redeemer, the Judge and the Comforter, which animate the pious. For these Native Americans, religious experience is something more direct and illuminating, more spontaneous, less the homemade product of the superficial, self-conscious mind. Sometimes, according to the reports collected by Dr. Slotkin, they see visions which may be of Christ himself. Sometimes they hear the voice of the Great Spirit. Sometimes they become aware of the presence of God and of those personal shortcomings which must be corrected if they are to do His will. The practical consequences of these chemical openings of doors into the other world seem to be wholly good. Dr. Slotkin reports that habitual peyotists are on the whole more industrious, more temperate, many of them abstain altogether from alcohol, more peaceable than non-peyotists. A tree with such satisfactory fruits cannot be condemned out of hand as evil. In sacramentalizing the use of peyote, the Indians of the Native American Church have done something which is at once psychologically sound and historically respectable. In the early centuries of Christianity, many pagan rites and festivals were baptized, so to say, and made to serve the purposes of the church. These jollifications were not particularly edifying, but they assuaged a certain psychological hunger, and instead of trying to suppress them, the earlier missionaries had the sense to accept them for what they were, soul-satisfying expressions of fundamental urges, and to incorporate them into the fabric of the new religion. What the Native Americans have done is essentially similar. They have taken a pagan custom, a custom incidentally far more elevating and enlightening than most of the rather brutish carousals and mummeries adopted from European paganism, and given it a Christian significance. Though but recently introduced into the northern United States, peyote eating and the religion based upon it have become important symbols of the red man's right to spiritual independence. Some Indians have reacted to white supremacy by becoming Americanized, others by retreating into traditional Indianism. But some have tried to make the best of both worlds, indeed of all the worlds, the best of Indianism, the best of Christianity, and the best of those other worlds of transcendental experience where the soul knows itself as unconditioned and of like nature with the divine. Hence the Native American Church. In it, two great appetites of the soul, the urge to independence and self-determination and the urge to self-transcendence, were fused with and interpreted in the light of a third, the urge to worship, to justify the ways of God to man, to explain the universe by means of a coherent theology. Quote, lo, the poor Indian whose untutored mind clothes him in front, but leaves him bare behind. End of quote. But actually, it is we, the rich and highly educated whites, who have left ourselves bare behind. We cover our anterior nakedness with some philosophy, Christian, Marxian, Freudo-physicalist, but abaft we remain uncovered, at the mercy of all the winds of circumstance. The poor Indian, on the other hand, has had the wit to protect his rear by supplementing the fig leaf of a theology with the breech clout of transcendental experience. I am not so foolish as to equate what happens under the influence of mescaline or of any other drug, prepared or in the future preparable, with the realization of the end and ultimate purpose of human life, enlightenment, the beatific vision. All I am suggesting is that the mescaline experience is what Catholic theologians call a gratuitous grace, not necessary to salvation, but potentially helpful, and to be accepted thankfully if made available. To be shaken out of the ruts of ordinary perception, to be shown for a few timeless hours the outer and the inner world, not as they appear to an animal obsessed with survival, or to a human being obsessed with words and notions, but as they are apprehended directly and unconditionally by mind at large. This is an experience of inestimable value to everyone, and especially to the intellectual. For the intellectual is by definition the man for whom, in Goethe's phrase, the word is essentially fruitful. He is the man who feels that what we perceive by the eye is foreign to us as such, and need not impress us deeply. And yet, though himself an intellectual and one of the supreme masters of language, Goethe did not always agree with his own evaluation of the word. "We talk," he wrote in middle life, "far too much. We should talk less and draw more. I personally should like to renounce speech altogether, and like organic nature, communicate everything I have to say in sketches. That fig tree, this little snake, the cocoon on my windowsill quietly awaiting its future, all these are momentous signatures." A person able to decipher their meaning properly would soon be able to dispense with the written or the spoken word altogether. The more I think of it, there is something futile, mediocre, even, I am tempted to say, foppish about speech. By contrast, how the gravity of nature and her silence startle you when you stand face to face with her, undistracted, before a barren ridge or in the desolation of the ancient hills. End of quote. We can never dispense with language and the other symbol systems, for it is by means of them, and only by their means, that we have raised ourselves above the brutes to the level of human beings. But we can easily become the victims as well as the beneficiaries of these systems. We must learn how to handle words effectively, but at the same time we must preserve and, if necessary, intensify our ability to look at the world directly and not through that half-opaque medium of concepts which distorts every given fact into the all-too-familiar likeness of some generic label or explanatory abstraction. Literary or scientific, liberal or specialist, all our education is predominantly verbal, and therefore fails to accomplish what it is supposed to do. Instead of transforming children into fully developed adults, it turns out students of the natural sciences, who are completely unaware of nature as the primary fact of experience, it inflicts upon the world students of the humanities who know nothing of humanity, their own or anyone else's. Gestalt psychologists such as Samuel Renshaw, have devised methods for widening the range and increasing the acuity of human perceptions. But do our educators apply them? The answer is no. T. Teachers in every field of psychophysical skill, from seeing to tennis, from tightrope walking to prayer, have discovered by trial and error the conditions of optimum functioning within their special fields. But have any of the great foundations financed a project for coordinating these empirical findings into a general theory and practice of heightened creativeness? Again, so far as I am aware, the answer is no. All sorts of cultists and queer fish teach all kinds of techniques for achieving health, contentment, peace of mind, and for many of their hearers, many of these techniques are demonstrably effective. But do we see respectable psychologists, philosophers, and clergymen boldly descending into those odd and sometimes malodorous wells, at the bottom of which poor truth is so often condemned to sit? Yet once more the answer is no. And now look at the history of mescaline research. 70 years ago, men of first-rate ability described the transcendental experiences which come to those who, in good health, under proper conditions, and in the right spirit, take the drug. How many philosophers, how many theologians, how many professional educators have had the curiosity to open this door in the wall? The answer, for all practical purposes, is none. In a world where education is predominantly verbal, highly educated people find it all but impossible to pay serious attention to anything but words and notions. There is always money for, there are always doctorates in, the learned foolery of research into what for scholars is the all-important problem. Who influenced whom to say what when? Even in this age of technology, the verbal humanities are honored. The nonverbal humanities, the arts of being directly aware of the given facts of our existence, are almost completely ignored. A catalogue, a bibliography, a definitive edition of a third-rate versifier's ipsissima verba, a stupendous index to end all indexes, any genuinely Alexandrian project is sure of approval and financial support. But when it comes to finding out how you and I, our children and grandchildren, may become more perceptive, more intensely aware of inward and outward reality, more open to the spirit, less apt by psychological malpractices to make ourselves physically ill, and more capable of controlling our own autonomic nervous system, when it comes to any form of nonverbal education more fundamental and more likely to be of some practical use than Swedish drill, no really respectable persons in any really respectable university or church will do anything about it. Verbalists are suspicious of the nonverbal. Rationalists fear the given non-rational fact. Intellectuals feel that what we perceive by the eye or in any other way is foreign to us as such and need not impress us deeply. Besides, this matter of education in the nonverbal humanities will not fit into any of the established pigeonholes. It is not religion, not neurology, not gymnastics, not morality or civics, not even experimental psychology. This being so, the subject is, for academic and ecclesiastical purposes, non-existent, and may safely be ignored altogether, or left with a patronizing smile, to those whom the Pharisees of verbal orthodoxy call cranks, quacks, charlatans, and unqualified amateurs. "I have always found," Blake wrote rather bitterly, "that angels have the vanity to speak of themselves as the only wise. This they do with a confident insolence sprouting from systematic reasoning." Systematic reasoning is something we could not, as a species or as individuals, possibly do without. But neither, if we are to remain sane, can we possibly do without direct perception, the more unsystematic the better, of the inner and outer worlds into which we have been born. This given reality is an infinite which passes all understanding, and yet admits of being directly and in some sort totally apprehended. It is a transcendence belonging to another order than the human, and yet it may be present to us as a felt immanence, an experienced participation. To be enlightened is to be aware, always, of total reality in its immanent otherness, to be aware of it, and yet to remain in a condition to survive as an animal, to think and feel as a human being, to resort, whenever expedient, to systematic reasoning. Our goal is to discover that we have always been where we ought to be. Unhappily, we make the task exceedingly difficult for ourselves. Meanwhile, however, there are gratuitous graces in the form of partial and fleeting realizations. Under a more realistic, a less exclusively verbal system of education than ours, every angel, in Blake's sense of that word, would be permitted as a sabbatical treat, would be urged and even, if necessary, compelled to take an occasional trip through some chemical door in the wall into the world of transcendental experience. If it terrified him, it would be unfortunate, but probably salutary. If it brought him a brief but timeless illumination, so much the better. In either case, the angel might lose a little of the confident insolence sprouting from systematic reasoning and the consciousness of having read all the books. Near the end of his life, Aquinas experienced infused contemplation. Thereafter, he refused to go back to work on his unfinished book. Compared with this, everything he had read and argued about and written, Aristotle and the sentences, the questions, the propositions, the majestic summas, was no better than chaff or straw. For most intellectuals, such a sit-down strike would be inadvisable, even morally wrong. But the angelic doctor had done more systematic reasoning than any 12 ordinary angels, and was already ripe for death. He had earned the right, in those last months of his mortality, to turn away from merely symbolic straw and chaff to the bread of actual and substantial fact. For angels of a lower order and with better prospects of longevity, there must be a return to the straw. But the man who comes back through the door in the wall will never be quite the same as the man who went out. He will be wiser, but less cocksure, happier, but less self-satisfied, humbler in acknowledging his ignorance, yet better equipped to understand the relationship of words to things, of systematic reasoning to the unfathomable mystery which it tries forever vainly to comprehend.
This has been a presentation of BBC Audiobooks America. The Doors of Perception. Text copyright 1954, 1955, 1956 by Aldous Huxley. All rights reserved. Production copyright 1999 by BBC Audiobooks America. All rights reserved.